Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we'll have another program dealing with issues of immigration, something that we're planning on trying to do a number of programs on over the coming weeks and perhaps months, trying to find different ways to approach the subject from different angles. And now, certainly, it's something that is being hotly debated in Congress. It is being debated across the country. And very specifically, the focus of a lot of the conversation is, what do we do about the millions of people who are in the United States illegally? Our guest this morning, Peter Salins, who is Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Provost, I should say, of the State University of New York system, argues that perhaps in this debate over immigration and what to do with people who are undocumented, we're missing an important point. After all, this debate has embedded in it the question of identity, American identity. What does it mean to be an American, and how does one become one? And he says very much in this argument, we have lost sight of one of the main objectives, and that is the integration of newcomers into American civic life. That is the subject of a book that he authored that was published a couple of years ago, a book that is titled Assimilation American Style, in which he embraces that term that perhaps for a lot of people will have a negative connotations. This is a book that's published by Basic Books, and I'm sure that it's still available if you would like to take a look at it. And in this part of the show, we'll talk about some of the ideas that he outlines in the book. Just a little bit more about him. He is a scholar in the field of urban planning and has written and presented extensively on U.S. urban policies affecting New York City and also other American cities in the fields of housing, urban development, economic planning, and also immigration. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you might be listening, either over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you would happen to be listening on the internet around the United States, no matter where you are in this country, at least, you can use the toll-free line, and we'll pick up the tab. That's 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly give us a call. Dr. Salins, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate
pleasure.
It. Just to begin with a personal note, perhaps, just because that's the way you begin the book, I think that you know some people might look at your background in urban planning, and wonder why it is that this particular issue was something that you wanted to take on. And that's something that in the preface to the book, you make an effort to explain just why it is you decided to write about that. Maybe that would be a good place for us to start.
Certainly. Really, there were sort of two major background factors. One is that my parents were immigrants, and so I grew up in an immigrant household. I grew up in an immigrant household where at least the language at home was not English. My parents were fluent in English, but at home we spoke German. My parents had come to the United States from Germany in the late 1930s, and so I was very much aware of what it meant to be an immigrant. My parents put enormous value on assimilation and tried, you know, quite eagerly and I think successfully to integrate into American life. But they didn't stop speaking German at home. I mean, they spoke English perfectly fluently and well at work and in public, but they spoke German at home. So this notion that you have to give up your culture to become an American, was quite clearly not the case in my life, and I didn't think it was the case in general. That was one of the themes in the book. But the other reason that I wrote the book is that I have done a great deal of work on the economic and demographic factors in New York City. And I had, some years before I wrote this book, done a fairly comprehensive analysis of immigrants in New York City. And immigrants have been enormously important in the functioning of New York and actually in the sort of fairly considerable economic and social revival of the city. And it was my work on immigrants in New York which led to, my being asked to do this book, looking at immigration more broadly in the country. The point I made, though, that to the publisher when I was approached about the book was that the real story of America is not immigration per se. Many, many countries in the world have large numbers of immigrants. The miracle of America is that this is one of the very few countries in the world where we've been able to build a highly successful, unified society with a large and diverse immigrant mix. And the fact that that is not the case, even in some countries that are just as prosperous as ours, in Western Europe and elsewhere, indicates that we shouldn't assume that this is an automatic corollary of immigration. You can have large immigrant populations in a economically successful society and not achieve the kind of civic unity that we have in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, as you say, that's I think a central point that you make in the book, that that compared with other nations that have large immigrant populations, the United States has been more successful, perhaps not perfect, but certainly more successful than a lot of other places. And in the thing that caught our eye, I think, was an op-ed piece that you contributed to the New York Times, where you make the connection between the idea of the importance of assimilation and the immigration debate that is going on now, and the fact that we've lost sight, as I said at the beginning, we've lost sight of what seems to be the most important thing. How, maybe you can then connect those two ideas. Take this idea of assimilation, as you argue it, and connect it to, or maybe show how it's not been connected to, what we're talking about now.
I'll be happy to do that. Yeah. That's been a matter of great concern and frustration to me. In fact, even just yesterday evening, I moderated a panel on immigration at the Asia Society in New York. And most of the discussion by the panelists, as has been the case with most of the discussion around the immigration legislation being discussed in Congress, focuses only on labor market issues. And I think this notion that the only reason we should be concerned about immigration is because of its impact on the labor market. And this labor market focus is true on both what you might call the immigration left and the immigration right, meaning both the people that want to liberalize immigration law and those that want to make it more restrictive. But both imagine that the only issue is, do we need more workers? What kinds of workers do we need? How many more workers should we bring into the country? Are the immigrants here making a labor market contribution? Are they making less of a contribution? Are they competing with the American labor force? I want to sort of brush most of that aside, because that isn't the real issue. My own feeling, first of all, is that the empirical justification for the various labor market arguments is weak on both sides. But the real point is that regardless of the labor market impacts of immigration, the really important thing to look at is how we create, out of a diverse population, a unified society. We have gotten so used to living in a more or less unified society that I think we take it for granted. And I think that even though we look with horror at the riots and the immigrant suburbs of Paris and the breakup of Yugoslavia on ethnic lines and the Irish Catholic, Irish Protestant wars in Northern Ireland and the problems in India, we just, I guess, imagine that that can never happen in the United States, and that we're somehow immune from the tensions and the difficulties that other countries have had with ethnically diverse populations, and especially with populations that have become more diverse because of immigration.
Mm-hmm. Well,
my point is that this is absolutely not to be taken for granted. It's something that really we've been very fortunate, because we've developed a paradigm that has effectively dealt with this issue, and unless we keep our eye on that paradigm and build some key features into the current immigration legislation being discussed, we are going to lose this very important value. And So there are sort of three components to the legislation being discussed. One is what to do with the immigrants that are already here, that are not legally here and not documented. What should we do in terms of increasing the flow of new immigrants? You know, what format should we use for that? And the third is, how can we enhance border security? I think, A, those three issues are related to each other, and B, how we deal with those very much impacts on the future success of what I call the assimilation paradigm.
Yeah. Well, just the bottom line here is the poles of the discussion, at least going on in Washington, D.C. now, seem to be on the one hand, those people who are arguing, and a lot of these are people in the House, arguing that people here who are legally have broken the law, so what we need to do is approach this as a law enforcement issue, try to apprehend them and send them back to their countries of origin, and then also deal strongly with employers who knowingly employ people who are undocumented. On the other side of the Capitol, we have the Senate that's taking a different kind of approach. They seem to embrace this idea that the president has laid out to create what amounts to a guest worker program to allow people to be here legally and work here legally for some period of time, further than some people would take the step and say that some people, if they've been here for a long enough time, we should make it possible for them to be citizens. I think for you, though, the bottom line is that what citizenship is very important. If we think that integrating newcomers into American life is important. So it sounds as if you're making a strong argument for we should find a way to make it possible. And if I'm putting words in your mouth, tell me, we should, though, find a way to make it possible for people who are here illegally and who want to stay here to become citizens.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that one of the real problems and weaknesses of both the Senate bill and the president's position is the conflation of the rectification, if you want to use that word, legalization, rectification of the status of those that are undocumented that are here now, conflating that with the basis for allowing new immigrants into the country. And I think these are two separable issues. And on one of those components, I agree with the president and with the Senate. I think we absolutely must find a format, a path for those that are here undocumented to be here legally and to fully participate in American life. And the reason for that is obvious. First of all, nobody honestly believes we're going to deport 11 million people. Nobody believes we're even going to deport 1 million people. I don't even think there's anybody who thinks that we're going to deport 100,000 people. So that there's a certain element of sort of blowing smoke in this whole talk of not doing that. So essentially, we don't really have an option of sort of rewinding the tape and having the immigrants, the illegal immigrants, not here. We only have two options. We can continue to have them live in the shadows and be a marginalized and perhaps alienated population, which will become harder and harder for us to sort of successfully absorb in this sort of American, unified social and civic paradigm. Or we can try to rectify their status. And maybe as we rectify their status, we'll say, well, we shouldn't keep on allowing large numbers of illegal immigrants to come in. In the discussion that we had last night at the Asia Society, one of the panelists made a very good point that one of the reasons that this argument that we cannot, if you want to use for shorthand, amnesty the existing illegals, one reason that we cannot is always, that they broke the law and we shouldn't reward them for breaking the law. The argument that this panelist made, and I think she's correct, is that actually the American government and the American employers were fully complicit in that, and it was so blatantly sort of made clear that we had no intention whatsoever of enforcing these laws, and that we had no intention of going after employers or using rigorous criteria for employers to screen out potential illegals, that to, you know, after sort of like French police officer in Casablanca, to now suddenly say we're shocked that we have all these illegal immigrants, it's very disingenuous. But regardless of whether you think that you know, these immigrants knew they were breaking the law, and we, you know, that sets a bad precedent. Even if that were the case, we cannot have a large, you know, segment of the population living here under that kind of a shadow. And since we cannot deport them, the only solution is to find a pathway for them to become legal residents and ideally citizens of the country.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again our guest for this first hour of Focus 580, and we have a caller we will get right to. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Peter Salins. He is the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Provost of the State University of New York System. He's also a scholar in the field of urban planning and has written extensively on urban policies affecting big American cities, one of those things being immigration. He's the author of a book entitled Assimilation American Style, published by Basic Books back in 1997. And questions are welcome here in Champaign, Urbana. 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller calling from Eureka, and we'll talk with them right now on our line four.
Very interesting program. I just have some demographic statistical questions, very short. Is the accurate figure, put it, 11 to 12 million of illegals, and what percentage of those would be Hispanic?
As far as the exact number, obviously the very fact that they are illegal makes it very difficult to have a precise number. But there seems to be a fairly overwhelming consensus among demographers that we're in that zone. So let's say between 10 and 13. 10, I think, would be sort of the low side, and 13 might be the high side. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the op-ed piece in the Times on May 11th, I did some research on these demographic assumptions, and I was sort of satisfied that the 11 to 12 million figure is pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. As far as the Latino component, I would say probably more than three-quarters, and a very large percentage of the Latino component is from Mexico.
So we're looking at maybe 7, 8, 9 million in that. And I have heard that there are 600,000 illegal Canadian immigrants in this country. Does that have any accuracy or anything that you've heard?
I think that there may be some truth in that as well. And we forget that south of the border is not the only place where they come to the United States. The way they come to the United States varies, though. I think that the Canadians are more apt to sort of enter legally and simply stay, whether they're, you know,
second
students
question,
or visitors or whatever it is, and they simply don't return. And by the way, not all of the south of the border immigrants necessarily, come across in the way that we imagine crossing the Rio Grande or crossing the desert. And even many Latino and other illegal immigrants come legally and simply overstay their visas.
Second question, without immigration based on a falling birth rate, this is just a thought, would there be a net decrease in total population in this country?
Not for a while, because the immigrant population in the United States is so large, even the legal immigrant population, and the birth rate in that population is above the replacement rate. On top of that, even the non-immigrant Americans have a slightly higher birth rate than residents of, you know, Northern Europe or Japan or some of the other countries. So I think we're a long distance away from having a falling population, even if we were to restrict immigration. That doesn't mean that I support restricting immigration, but I don't think that the argument for immigration should be simply to make up a demographic shortfall, just like I don't think it should be done to make up a labor market shortfall.
Mm-hmm. I just asked a third, but it seems to me, based on what I've read, the nation of Russia is facing a 750,000 decrease in population. I believe I've seen projections that in 20 or 25 years, Japan and Italy will have 25% less, and without immigration, I believe France and Germany would both be net losers in population. Is that accurate? I'll get off the air. Thank you.
I think it is accurate. In the case of Russia, though, I mean, I think that the case of Japan and most of northwestern Europe, I think we have low birth rates accounting for that. In the case of Russia, we also have high death rates added to low birth rates, causing the demographic decline.
Hmm. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something I'm interested in your perspective on is how it is that perhaps the nature of being an immigrant coming to the United States has changed, or maybe it hasn't changed.
I'm glad you asked that question. Uh-huh. Actually, one of the things that I think is most widely misunderstood is this issue of whether assimilation is the result of the behavior of immigrants or the result of the behavior of the host country. Hmm. I feel very strongly, and I think there's a good empirical research basis for making this claim, that the extent of assimilation and the success of assimilation is always the result of the behavior of the host country and not of the immigrants. We've had an enormously varied mix of immigrants over the years. And even though everybody thinks that the immigrants that came in the 19th century must have been easier to assimilate than the immigrants that have come in the 20th and now in the 21st, not so. Actually, in the early days, even, you know, the Germans and the Scandinavians and later the Irish were seen as being, you know, quite problematical in terms of the way in which their cultures and their attitudes, in some cases, for example, in the case of the Germans, even their language, varied from that of the host country. The reason assimilation succeeded in the 19th century and in the 20th and can in the 21st is because of our attitudes, the attitudes of the host country, of the United States, toward immigrants, a combination of, I think, two things, and that's the basic theme of the book. One part of it is the fact that we have this tolerance for diversity in America that many nations don't have. I think that's one of our strengths, and I would hope that we would continue to have that. But the other is that our definition of assimilation is grounded in values rather than cultural habits. We're really quite flexible and tolerant of cultural diversity, which is good. What we really insist on, and that was the main thesis of Assimilation American Style, is a unity of values. And the values that most important are the sort of adherence to the national civic paradigm of democracy and civil rights and civil liberties and so forth. And the other is very explicitly called the Protestant ethic, which now applies primarily to population that may not be Protestant in terms of religious affiliation, but essentially the work ethic and the valuing of individuals for their contribution and their character rather than their ethnicity. So we really, I think, as a country, have been very consistent in valuing individuals for their own unique attributes and not being as concerned about what sociologists call their ascribed characteristics of ethnicity or religion or whatever. And I think that notion that we have a sort of set of rules for becoming a member of our society that anybody from any nation can quickly relate to, I think has been the key to our success. So it doesn't really matter whether we're now getting individuals from Mexico or elsewhere in Latin America or Asia, as opposed to getting individuals or families from Eastern or Western or Northern Europe.
Because now it is easier to maintain contact with people's place of origin, and I suppose if they have the means, it's also easier to go back and forth. Is that likely to change the way people think about the United States or where they came from in ways that would make it substantially different than how previous immigrants thought when we look back to a time when once you got here, the idea of going back home was pretty much impossible?
I think what it does do, I think that it does, create a problem or a potential problem or an issue, and it, I think, raises the stakes in terms of the extent to which we really should try very hard to continually reinforce what I consider the ingredients of the assimilation paradigm. It's a free country and it's a free world, and people, are certainly free to go back to their former countries, and there's no way that we could stop it, or no reason that we should stop it. But given the fact that that could possibly erode the identification and allegiance to the United States, I think it's all the more important that we make assimilation a cornerstone of immigration policy. So, I would never suggest that we do anything to restrict this back and forth, and we couldn't in any case. But it does mean that we really shouldn't be so indifferent to some of the main markers. And what do I mean by that? I mean, one of the third pillar of the paradigm, which we haven't talked much about, is the acceptance of English as the main civic language or public language. I mean, even in my family, as I indicated, we spoke German at home, but we clearly saw ourselves living in an English-speaking society. So I do think we have to reinforce it. We don't have to be, heavy-handed about it, and I don't know if I support these sort of English-only kinds of laws that are being, that occasionally get offered. But we should sort of reinforce the idea that English is the national language, and that we would really encourage everyone as quickly as possible to become fluent in English. I think the other issues, though, is the strengthening of especially of the civic paradigm. I don't think we have much to worry about as far as the work ethic. I think that immigrants come to the United States, with a strong work ethic, and I think they display it with more consistency than Native Americans. But we tend to become a little bit ambivalent about the civic paradigm sometimes, and I think we need to strengthen that particular component. And I think that even though I think that we should certainly welcome ethnic diversity and celebrate ethnic diversity, we shouldn't use ethnic identity as an important political variable. In other essays that I've written, I point out that when you start mixing ethnic and political issues, you are sowing the seeds for civic disunity. And we even see that in the daily discussions on the Sunni-Shiite-Kurd mix in Iraq and the impact that has on creating a unified government. There's not much we can do about it at this point, and Iraq is not the United States, but it is not good to have a political system that tries to parcel out political authority or power in proportion to ethnic affiliation.
We have several callers here. We'll try to get some more folks in, and we're a little bit past the midpoint. Perhaps I should introduce again the guest for this hour of our program. We're talking with Dr. Peter Sallins. He's the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Provost of the State University of New York System. He oversees academic programs and operations at the 64 campuses of the State University. In his academic background, he is a scholar in the field of urban planning. He's written and presented extensively on U.S. urban policies affecting New York, and other American cities in a number of fields, including housing, urban development, economic planning, and immigration. His recent scholarly work includes the book Assimilation American Style, published by Basic Books back in 1997. And we have several callers here, others who welcome into the conversation. 333-9455, that's the number for people in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll talk next with someone listening in Chicago on line four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. During the 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement, we got a lot of sympathy from the Japanese who were locked up during World War II. A lot of support. I was wondering, has that passed over today? Do the civil rights leaders have sympathy for the immigrants that are, you know, people are talking about, we need to do something about immigration? Do they see a similar situation?
Could you clarify? I mean, I don't know if I fully understand the question.
Well, I'm saying that during the 60s, when the civil rights movement was coming on, we were getting rid of segregation and discrimination, there was a lot of sympathy from the Japanese community because they had been interned during the war.
Mm-hmm.
They saw this situation as being similar. What I'm saying today is the civil rights leaders of today, how do they feel about this problem of immigration? Are they sympathetic? Does it remind them of the time that they had their problems in the 60s? That's what I wanted to know.
Probably not. I mean, I can't really legitimately speak for civil rights leadership, but my impression would be that that is not the case. In fact, the civil rights leadership, well, first of all, that there's several different strands of civil rights leadership. There's the African-American community, which I think is somewhat ambivalent about immigrants and immigration and wouldn't probably be overly sympathetic to policies that would make it easier for immigrants to...
Well, I noticed that happened
in the United States. I mean, again, I don't have any you know, sort of concrete evidence of that, but I would gather that there isn't a huge amount of...
Yeah, I noticed that happens down through American history. Now, the Irish, when they came over here, they were used to a sign that said, no Irish need apply. Victims of terrible discrimination. Yet when the Civil War came, they were less than enthusiastic about emancipation.
Well, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think that people very quickly forget their own
roots. Because
and I think that in any, you know, and it isn't just a matter of immigration, I think in almost any situation, once people have sort of crossed the drawbridge, they're quite prepared to pull it up
they
behind
usually...
them, and I think immigration is no exception. But I don't think that, I mean, that the policy isn't driven by that. I think that there is one area where there might be some misunderstanding that it would be good for economists and others to clarify. There is probably a fear on the part of representatives of working-class Americans and lower-income Americans that immigrants are a threat economically. And I think that we have good empirical evidence.
Well, what do you think about
that? They're not.
What do you think about the argument that this might be a good way to smuggle terrorists into the country?
I think that the that's an important issue, and it's come up at a number of the panels that I've participated in. My own feeling is that the antidote to terrorism is civic unity. Yes, if we are vigilant enough, perhaps we can keep terrorists from entering the country. But the greatest risk is really not people entering the country. It's people in the country feeling alienated and willing to do these kinds of things. That the terrorists in Britain a few years ago were long resident in Britain. They did not sneak into Britain to do those,
well, some of the terrorist
bombs on the subway system. And even though the majority of the World Trade Center terrorists had come into the United States recently, the real danger to the United States would not be from that, you know, kind of activity, people coming in. It would be from pockets of alienated residents in America, whether they're Muslim or have some other basis for their grievance. So that
reinforces,
let me just finish my point, that reinforces, I believe, the need to make sure that we don't have large alienated immigrant minorities in our midst, and I think argues for strengthening the ties within our country.
Okay, thank you.
No, no, no. Well, let's continue. We'll go to a caller in Aurora. This is line number one. Hello.
I'm making other information available, and I guess I'm a little angry. I know a fellow that comes from Slovakia in Europe, and he came to this country. He's getting educated, but he has what he calls a dual citizenship. That's available. So when he has to get anything medically done, like his teeth, etc., he goes back to Slovakia. Whatever he can get in America, he gets in America. And that irritates me. Maybe I shouldn't be, but I am.
Well, and, Dr. Challens, what do you think about the idea of dual citizenship?
Well, first of all, contrary to what people believe, it is not legal. At least
what
it really
Would
is
speak
is
a
that,
louder?
That, that dual citizenship is not officially sanctioned. It is probably almost impossible to prevent. But actually, for those that, and again, what I'm talking about is dual citizenship, meaning being a citizen, you know, which is a legal status in the United States, and also being a citizen of another country. Because when one takes the oath of citizenship, one forswears allegiance to any other nation. That is in the citizenship oath. Now, it is not something that we have, enforced rigorously or even attempted to enforce. But it is a myth that the United States permits dual citizenship. Other countries may, but the United States specifically does not. I personally think dual citizenship is not a good idea, and I think that to the extent to which the current citizenship oath and citizenship process envisions unitary citizenship, meaning that when you're a citizen of the United States, you're only a citizen of the United States. I think it would not be a bad idea to try to reinforce this. Again, I'm less concerned about any kind of legal actions, more concerned about, you know, the cultural message that we send, including in the training and the manuals and other things that lead up to citizenship. As far as preventing people from other countries going back to their native lands for medical care, I don't think it's a huge problem, and I wouldn't get too exercised about it. But I am more concerned about the notion that we seem to believe that dual citizenship is legal and that it's acceptable. I think it is neither.
The other thing, you can't do anything with people that have a green card. How long is a green card good for?
I think it can be renewed indefinitely, I believe.
Oh, because a lot of these people with green cards, they just stay here. Once they come here, they just stay here.
Well, that goes back to another issue that I've raised in both my book and in other articles. It would be desirable for us to sort of send a stronger message that citizenship is good, and we really should encourage the vast majority of legal immigrants to become citizens. I have written that we've gotten somewhat casual about it or relaxed about it, and I think we shouldn't. I think that the United States was quite unique in creating a rapid path to citizenship right from the outset, from the founding of the country. And I think that that's been an important part of what I consider to be the American assimilation paradigm. I think citizenship is important. We have made citizenship remarkably easy compared to the case even in a lot of modern countries in the world. We should build on that, and we should strongly encourage all immigrants to become citizens. I don't think we can compel it or should compel it, but we certainly should try to reinforce the idea that this should happen.
My sister just got back from Slovakia, and she said it's very, very difficult for people to come to rich countries from Slovakia Because the government knows that once they get here, they will stay. Very difficult to come over. And, of course, I would like my cousins to visit here, but it's very difficult for them to come. So I will let you go and thank you for your very educating program.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have about 15 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest for the show is Dr. Peter Salins. He's the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Provost for the State University of New York system and is a scholar in the field of urban planning. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back here to another caller in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm glad I don't have to argue that a lot of the isolation is due to the host country's attitudes. I thought I would have to, but you started out by a strong argument in that, in favor of that. I appreciate that. yeah, there's, you know, I think newcomers see selective law enforcement, and they, and in particular Mexican Americans in the media, see that there's no parity with their actual numbers, and there's nothing very welcoming about that. You know, when you're a newcomer, you see things with fresh eyes, and naturally, some things are going to give you deep reservations. I grew up in an area where blacks were considered subhuman, but I, you know, it was obvious to me that, you know, that was completely erroneous notion, and should I have assimilated? And even in the most sympathetic of locations, for example, there's a local grade school here that I volunteered at for a while. I've seen Mexican-American kids isolated and apparently ostracized on the playground, but I never saw any of the professional staff coming to their aid. So I just wanted to speak up in favor of the notion that the hostility of the host country is very, very part of what's going on. You know, Mexican-Americans in particular really believe in morality, but they're very practical people, as you would conclude if you realize just how difficult it is to live on sub-minimum wages, you know. And I guess if I have a question, it would be that there's a lot of noise about the citizenship issue, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about what the implications are for citizenship in the context of that the United States itself has kind of a problematic idea of citizenship in the world and the region. And in particular, for example, we like to talk of our being a land of a country of laws, and yet when it comes to our world citizenship, we have no regard for the International Criminal Court, for example. I'm just wondering if you saw any kind of link between our world citizenship and...
I would strongly sever any discussion of foreign policy and these other issues and the the issues of immigration and assimilation. So I would stay away from that, and I don't think that there's much productive in terms of policy that we can glean from that. But I do see a number of points that you made that are relevant. And I think that the key is that if we really believe, and I strongly believe, that we must create a format for immigrants to happily and successfully join the national family in the United States, certainly, we have to have legal pathways for people to do this. So to begin with, illegal immigration, even if it's convenient for both the immigrants initially, who are probably bettering their economic status even at very low pay, and even if it's convenient for employers who get inexpensive labor. That is no reason to sort of, you know, depend on that as the major pathway into the country. So I feel strongly that even though we should allow a large number of immigrants to come to the country, we should be, I think, quite open and tolerant as to the national mix and the occupational mix. I don't believe in designer immigration policy, and I don't think we could design it properly anyway. But we do have to, if we're going to have roughly 1.3 million individuals come into the United States, we have to find a way that virtually all of them do so legally. And as far as the further integration, I think that, apropos of the previous caller, it is very important to encourage citizenship and to ease the path to citizenship. As far as discrimination on the playgrounds of whatever community you were referring to, clearly that's unacceptable. But that does get exacerbated, I believe, by the perception that people have that those Mexican families are not in the community legitimately. And I think that that's no excuse for discrimination in any case. But I do believe that everything that we can do to make it possible for people to come to the country legally would be beneficial. One thing that we haven't talked about much, David, is the guest worker issue that came up in the that's embedded in the Senate legislation and is supported by the president. Mm-hmm. I think the guest worker idea is bad because we have then created a category of individual who's living among us who, almost by definition, is not being asked to join the American family, is not being asked to assimilate. If we would like to make it easier for an additional 200,000, which I think is what the Senate number is, to 400,000, which I think is a more realistic number, if we want to make it easier for 200,000 to 400,000 more immigrants to come, I think we should do it essentially on a kind of first-come, first-served waiting list basis. And I think if we did that, the pressure to come to the country illegally would be strongly reduced. It would be reduced in the part of employers because they would be able to, in this new immigrant pool of legal immigrants, would be able to staff up their firms or their farms. But the important thing is from the immigrant side, right now, unless even a Mexican has a relative in the United States, and even most Mexicans do not have American relatives, or unless you are skilled in one of a very, very narrow set of occupations and have a specific employer willing to sponsor you, there is really no way to get into the country legally. And I think that we have to have a way for immigrants from around the world, but especially from this hemisphere, to come to the United States that don't necessarily have relatives here, that don't necessarily have a particular skill or a particular employer. And I think if we create that kind of a pathway, I think that the pressure on border enforcement would be reduced considerably.
We have time. We have several callers, and unfortunately not time for all of them. We will try to get at least one more here. The next person in line is in Champaign, so we'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'll try to keep it brief, and thank you for the discussion. Going back to the question of dual citizenship, my information may be way outdated, but my daughter was born in Germany when my husband and I were working for the American Red Cross in Germany. So we were American citizens. She was automatically an American citizen when she was born, but also had to be registered. Her birth was registered with the German Standesamt in Bad Cannstatt, where she was born. And we were told she had dual citizenship until she was, I think, 13, theoretically, she would have had a chance to choose to go back to Germany if she had wanted to. This is long past, but does that law only apply to certain countries?
The problem is that we don't have a specific piece of legislation dealing with the issue. What we have is our regular citizenship protocol. Now, your daughter is sort of an exception to that because she came by the sort of dual citizenship potential by having been born to American parents in another country. That's sort of untypical.
And there must have been hundreds, though, of children born.
Yes, I'm sure there are, but it's not the vast majority of individuals for whom this would be an issue are people that actually have, chosen to become American citizens, consciously. Now, for them, they are being asked to renounce citizenship in their former country.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of your daughter, since she never had to go through a citizenship protocol, automatically was an American citizen. And so in that case, the issue of dual citizenship lies entirely with the other country, meaning Germany in this case.
Yes.
And I don't know how one would, even try to enforce that kind of thing. I don't think it's a huge problem, but I do think it's important. I think, to me, the cultural issues and the attitudes trump the laws. And I think even in the debate that we have on illegal immigration, the shift is not so much in the law, but in our level of tolerance for the flouting of a law that's been flouted for 20 years. So I think that what I look to in this debate is a shift in our cultural attitudes, and one of those shifts should be to see citizenship as an important component of American society, an important component of assimilation, and I would like to see a cultural shift away from excessive tolerance of dual citizenship.
We're going to have to stop for the moment. I'm sure that many of these issues we'll take up on other days with other guests, but for right now, we'll have to close out this hour and thank our guest, Dr. Peter Sallins. He's the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs and Provost of the State University of New York System. He's also a scholar in the field of urban planning. He's the author of the book Assimilation American Style, published by Basic Books in 1997. Dr. Sallins, thank you very much.
Thank you.